Chapter 33 Hunger. Sometime in mid-February, Mitchell and Barzee got into a terrible fight. This wasn't anything new. They fought, literally, every day. Heck, they fought almost every hour. But this one was different. It was the worst fight I had ever seen. He was screaming and cursing and threatening with things that I couldn't even imagine. Finally, Barzee grabbed a kitchen knife and held it to her wrist. "I'm going to kill myself!" she screamed. She had done this before, but this time I actually thought that she might do it. She pressed the knife against her skin. Mitchell didn't seem to care. "I'm going to do it! I'm going to kill myself! I just can't take it any longer! You don't deserve me! I don't deserve this! I'm going to kill myself right now!" Mitchell finally jumped toward her to pull the knife away. They tussled back and forth, and I wondered if one of them would stab the other. Finally, Mitchell emerged from the scrum, the knife in hand, but the fighting went on. Listening to all of the screaming and ranting made me sick. It seemed to drive the very sunlight from the sky. It filled the camp with darkness and misery and a hateful, dreadful feeling that made me want to crawl away. I crouched in the back of the tunnel tent. I didn't want them to see me, for I knew that if they did, one or the other would turn their rage on me. So I huddled out of the way, listening to the screaming, while keeping my head down and staying out of it. In a final fit of rage, Barzee stormed off, cursing everything about Mitchell that she could think of, which turned out to be a lot. I listened to her voice fade away as she wandered off into the dark. She was gone all night. It wasn't until late afternoon the next day that she came out of her hiding place in the rocks. As she stomped into camp, I could see that she was different. There was a renewed fire in her eyes. She was intense and animated. She was full of, I don't know, an evil energy that seemed to give her more nerve than she had ever shown before. "Satan and his hosts surrounded and tortured me last night," she said. For such a dramatic announcement, there was no drama or excitement in her voice. She said it matter-of-factly, as if she were announcing that it was cold or that it had rained. Mitchell only looked at her. Devil or no, he wasn't ready to forgive or forget. "They came and tortured me all night," Barzee went on. "Hours and hours of their taunting, their dark whispers, their rage and hate inside my ears. Then they tortured me. And I'm not imagining. It was very real. It was as if they placed a piercing laser at my feet and ran it up my body. It was pure agony. I've never felt anything even close to it before. Searing, burning pain. My body being cut in two. I can't describe it. It is impossible. I was cut from feet to skull." I tried not to look at her. It was a horrible thing to say, yet I almost believed her. If anyone could become a plaything for the devil, certainly she and Mitchell could. Mitchell started to say something, but Barzee quickly cut him off. She was tired of him talking. She was tired of his preaching. She was tired of it all. It was her turn to talk, and Mitchell was going to listen. That was clear from the fire in her eyes. She swallowed, as if she were pondering her words. "I have something more to tell you. The fight is over for me now. My election to heaven has been made sure. It doesn't matter what I do now. I have suffered and bled enough. I have been measured, and I am worthy. My place in heaven is assured. I don't have to follow you any longer, Emmanuel. I no longer even have to follow in the footsteps of the Lord. I am going up to heaven. My place in the celestial world is guaranteed."
That must be pretty cool, I thought. Do anything you want, still get to heaven.
You're one of the few who gets that deal.
But of course, I didn't believe it. She was just a sick and evil soul. She and Mitchell were nothing more than two malicious and self-serving people who justified their own behavior by twisting the truth. Barzee squared her shoulders.
"But you, Emmanuel, you are not following in God's footsteps anymore."
Her voice was high and piercing. She was more than full of fury. She was a cat trapped in a corner and hissing at a wolf. You certainly aren't acting like the Davidic king, and worse, you're not treating me like the mother of Zion that I am. I am tired of it, and you must stop it. I'm not going to put up with it anymore. She stopped to take a breath, waiting for Mitchell to answer. For a long time, he didn't say anything. Then he exploded in rage, and that started it off. It was the same thing as the day before, the same loud screaming and selfish arguments. After a few minutes, Mitchell stopped arguing, sat down, and started to pull his shoes on. Barzee realized that he was leaving, and that threw more fuel on her rage. You can't just leave me here again. You have to stay. You're going to talk to me. You're going to face this now. But apparently, he wasn't. Mitchell grabbed his handmade money bag and the linen cap he only wore when going into the city. Barzee kept on screaming, The Lord has sent me to chastise you. You will not walk away. I'm going into town, Mitchell said in a quiet voice. I don't know when I'll be back. He shoved the hat onto his head, then turned around and walked away. I sank down in despair. I knew it would take him until dark before he would even get into the city, which meant he probably wouldn't be coming back that night. That meant another day without any food. The only thing we had eaten all day was a small crust of bread with a tiny bit of mayo, and the last remaining rings from a slice of an old onion. I had eaten maybe a couple thousand calories in the past week. It had been that way for months. My stomach was constantly aching. I was already weak and dizzy. The thought of going another day without anything to eat was almost more than I could bear. Barzee stormed back into the tent, all the time ranting about Mitchell. All I could do was sit and listen, trying to stay out of her way. She went on and on, hours and hours of her ranting. Sometime well into the night, she finally turned to me and said, We have spoken long. It is late now. Let us pray and go to bed. What do you mean by we? I wanted to say. I haven't said a word in hours, but yes, please, let's go to bed. When I woke up, the first thing I thought about was food. I got up and searched through the camp for something to eat, but everything was gone. Barzee picked up her ranting where she left off the night before. By mid-afternoon, she was finally out of rage. There was silence for a couple of hours, and then she said, I'm sure he's on his way back. I'm sure he'll bring us water. I'm sure he'll bring us food. I thought back on the single piece of crust and ring of onion I had eaten the day before. The day before that, I had eaten little more. I had been on a path of malnutrition for many weeks now, leaving me weak and vulnerable. I would have done anything for something to eat. I would have done anything for something to drink. I was beyond mere thirst and hunger. I was beyond misery and despair. The day ended. Still, no Mitchell. Where is he? I was screaming in frustration in my head. Day 3 came. Barzee seemed resigned to suffering through it, however it was to end. As quickly as she had gathered up the will to fight Mitchell, she had lost it now. If he had left us here to die, that seemed to be okay with her. We sat around in silence. We just didn't have the energy to talk. Besides, it hurt my throat to speak. I was as dry as a bone. I didn't think I was going to starve to death, at least not yet, but I knew that I could die of dehydration if I didn't get something to drink. My tongue was dry and swollen. My throat was as rough as sandpaper, not letting my thick saliva go down. 3 days in the heat and dryness, 3 days without food or water. My heart raced every time that I walked or even stood up. My body was on edge. That afternoon, I lay weakly on my bed and thought back on the miraculous glass of water that had appeared by my pillow on that night back in the mountains. It seemed so long ago. Please, God, I started praying. It was hard to even form the words. Please, God, I need another miracle. I can't go another day without any water. If I don't drink, I'm going to die here. Please. Help me find a way to go on. Weak, exhausted, and demoralized to the point of losing hope, I drifted off to sleep. Shortly after, I woke to a splattering sound on our tent. It took me a while to figure out what was going on. Then it finally hit me. Rain! It was raining! I was overcome with relief. Then the words came very clearly into my mind. I will not leave you comfortless. I will come to you. I closed my eyes to thank him and then climb out of the tent. It was a fierce storm, rife with water, the rain coming down in enormous drenching drops. Barzee jumped up and we worked together. We grabbed the spare tarp and tied it up to catch the rain. Then we put out every bucket, can, and container that we could find to catch the rain. As the rain pooled on the tarp, I poured it into one of the containers. Once I had a mouthful, I lifted it to my mouth and gulped it down. I let it fill once more and gulped again. I poured and gulped and poured and gulped until I started feeling sick. I was drinking so much water, I knew I had to quit. Glancing over, I looked at Barzee. She was on her hands and knees, sucking water off the tarp. Once we had quenched our thirst and filled every container that we had, Barzee told me to get the soap. "We're going to shower in the rain," she said. We scrubbed ourselves, then wearily went to bed. The next morning came, but Mitchell didn't. We lay on our beds all day. "Is he ever coming back?" I asked Barzee. "I don't know," she said. "Has he ever done this before? Has he ever left you for so long?" She slowly shook her head. "Do you think..." "I don't know," she snapped at me. Day 5. No food. Hot and hazy, I hardly had the strength to move. Barzee and I sat around and talked, but only just a little. I felt too tired, too weak. I lay in the tent and dreamed all day of food. Day 6. I felt so weak and dizzy, it was almost impossible to walk to the bucket to get some water. I lay on my bed and stared up at the gray tarp. I felt like all my hope was slipping away. My life was nothing but sand through my fingers, water through my palms. I knew I had to eat or I would die, but I didn't know what to do. On day 7, Barzee seemed to lose her mind. Struggling to stand, she walked over and pulled out the recipe book that she had painstakingly put together over so many years. She looked at it with dry eyes, then started to tear out the pages and shred them on the ground. I watched her curiously. She ripped and scratched until she had torn out every page. I looked at the scattered pieces, the perfect cakes and salads, the delicious pastas and desserts. I wanted to chew on every piece of paper. I wanted to stuff them in my mouth, but a sudden breeze came up and blew them all away. In final desperation, I crawled to the trash pile in the back of our tent and sorted through it one more time, looking for anything that I could eat. Every last shred of food was gone. I struggled back to my bed and collapsed. I lay there, waiting. What I was waiting for, I didn't know. Thinking of my situation, I almost laughed at the irony. After everything that I had lived through, the kidnapping, the knife at my neck, the daily rapes, the different moves, the months of abuse from my two captors, it seemed almost laughable that I was going to die of starvation in my tent. For the 1,000th time, I wondered where Mitchell was. Was he ever coming back? As I lay there, I started to wonder if this really was the end. Then I started to think about my family. No, that's not right. I thought about my family all the time. But as I lay there, I thought back on all the good things in my life, deciding that I had been very lucky. Almost all of my 15 years of living had been about as perfect as one could hope for. Sure, the last 8 months had been pretty terrible, but everything before had been near perfect. I thought about my beautiful mom and imagined how she would take care of me if she were with me then. I thought about my dad, who is strong and capable of fixing any problem I might have. When it came to a great family, I felt like I had won the lottery, and that included my brothers and sister, my grandparents, my aunts and uncles. I couldn't have asked for a more caring, loving family. So I began to thank God for my life, my family, and the blessings that I had received in my short life. Then, not knowing if I could make it another day, I tried to think of things that I had done wrong and to ask God for forgiveness. When I finished my prayer, I lay still and waited to die. It was in that moment that far off in the distance, I heard singing. Had heavenly angels come to get me? No. This was something else. It was loud and off-key, and the melodies were completely mixed up. It took me a second to realize that it was Mitchell. I was almost disappointed. He was about as far from a heavenly host as you can get. Mitchell came panting and stomping into camp. Neither Barzee nor I had the energy to greet him. We waited until he stuck his head inside the tent. "Food," we started begging. He looked at us a moment. It must have been an incredible sight, the two of us lying on our makeshift beds, too weak to even move. But he didn't say anything. In fact, he didn't react at all. He didn't rush to Barzee's side or jump around to get us something to eat. He didn't offer to bring us any water. He didn't even ask how we were. Instead, he kind of smiled proudly. "I was walking through Lakeside when I passed the local KFC. They were throwing out their leftovers for the day. I asked if I could have them for my starving wife and daughter." He pulled out macaroni and cheese, chicken, a couple of biscuits, coleslaw, and potato wedges. I rolled onto my knees and reached out for the food, guiding a couple pieces to my mouth with shaking hands. I had thought that I could eat the entire bag, but after a few bites, I started feeling stuffed. Another bite, and I started feeling sick. Realizing it was going to take a while for my body to adjust, I quit trying to eat and lay back on my mat. "Where have you been?" Barzee asked in anger. Her voice was dry and accusing. Mitchell smiled as if he didn't have a care in the world and started to tell his tale. The first thing he did upon getting to Lakeside was going into the convenience store to steal some beer. After gulping a couple of Budweisers in the aisle, he walked out of the store and saw a woman pushing a shopping cart while popping a few pills. "Ah," he thought, "the next step I must take in my quest to descend below all things." He went up to the woman and asked her for some of her pills. She refused, of course, so he grabbed her cart and started running. After getting away from her, he opened her purse and grabbed the prescription medication. Popping some into his mouth, he abandoned the stolen loot, then turned and ran, the lady in hot pursuit. He jumped over a fence and kept on running. The drugs and beer, a really bad combination, started to kick in, and he was getting wobbly. Soon after, he came to a church, the perfect place to spend the night. But all of the doors were locked. That wasn't right. He was the prophet of the Lord, and the church was nothing but an abomination with evil people who went inside. Who were they to deny him access to his father's house? So, he found a brick and broke the window, then crawled inside and fell unconscious on the floor. And that's where the police had found him. He didn't remember a lot about being booked into jail other than the fact that he was able to flash a female officer from underneath his robe. He was really proud of that. 7 days later, having given the police a fake name and having told the judge that he had been clean for 20 years and how sorry he was that he had fallen off the wagon, and that, of course, he was willing to pay for the damages and do loads of community service, but that all he wanted now was to get back to his family. The judge had let him go. He hung around the city for the rest of the day, then made his way back to camp. "For 7 days, you left us!" Barzee hissed like a snake. "7 days without so much as a single scrap to eat!" "I thought you'd go down to Lakeside and get something," Mitchell answered without regret. "For 7 days you were in jail. You got 3 square meals a day. We had nothing. You had a real bed with a pillow and soft blankets. We had this." She lifted a finger to the gray tarps and the dirty bedding around us. "You had hot showers and a television and books and anything else you could desire. We had nothing. We had nothing. You left us here to die. Mitchell shook his head.
It was the Lord who called me to prison. I had 7 days of preaching to the inmates, 7 days of crying repentance to the sinful. All I did was serve the Lord.
Barzee lay back on her sleeping bag and closed her eyes. I was about to point out that no one in jail had been converted, but decided there was no point in stirring things up. A few moments passed. It appeared that Barzee was already asleep. Mitchell and I were alone together, and I stared into his eyes. He looked at me and held my stare, refusing to look away. My unspoken words were very clear. You tried to kill me, but you didn't. For all your talk of being a mighty prophet, I am stronger than you are. One day, you're going to know that. One day, you're going to see. The battle between us lasted only a few seconds. Then, for the first time since he had slipped into my bedroom, Mitchell was the first one to look away.
Chapter 34. Manipulating Mitchell.
Mitchell was always driven by events. There was never a simple coincidence, nor did things ever happen just by chance. Everything that happened had to be a sign from God. One afternoon near the end of February, a couple weeks after Mitchell had abandoned us to our hunger, we were sitting outside our tents. Mitchell had decided he wasn't going to go and minister that day. Too much work, much too hot. The Lord wanted him to stay in the camp. So he spent the day sitting around, talking about his favorite subject, which was, of course, himself. Barzee was lapping up every word. I was hardly even listening. After 8 months of listening to him every minute of every day, there wasn't a whole lot about him that I hadn't heard before. But I always tried at least to act like I was paying attention. There was a steep price to pay if he felt like I didn't give him the respect he thought he deserved. But I wasn't listening. I was daydreaming about my family, about my friends, wondering if I would ever be able to go back to school. It was a sunny day, and the skies were clear. It was already getting hot, and I wondered what the summers would be like in California. Was I going to spend the rest of my life here? Was I going to spend the rest of my life on top of this mountain, miles from anyone and anything, surrounded by boulders and scrub oaks? Would we ever go back to Utah? I really didn't know. Sitting there, I started to hear the low roar of helicopter rotors. The sound grew louder, and Mitchell immediately stood up. The roar of engines and beating blades began to fill the air. Mitchell shoved me into the tent, then grabbed Barzee and pulled her in as well. Standing near the entrance, he jerked down the flap that we used for a door. The sound of the helicopter grew louder. It was coming right toward us. He motioned for Barzee and me to scoot to the back of the tent. I slid backward, keeping my face toward the door. The helicopter came to hover right over our camp. There was a deafening roar of engines and the wind stirred up a terrible swirl of dust. The tarp tunnel was shaking so badly, I thought it was going to be blown away. For a moment, I flashed back to the afternoon in the mountains over Salt Lake City, 3 days after I had been taken. But unlike that afternoon, this time I wasn't anxious or excited. Whoever was in the helicopter, and for whatever reason they had to come check out our camp, I was pretty certain they weren't looking for me. I knew soldiers weren't going to rappel from the helicopter to save me. Still, I kept my eyes toward the sound. After all, you never know. The helicopter hovered a few minutes, then moved on. Mitchell made us stay inside the tent until he was certain it was safe. When he finally allowed us to come out, he was a changed man once again. Less confident, not as cocky, full of doubts and fear. He looked at Barzee and said, "That is a sign from God. It's time that we move again." I knew it wasn't a sign of anything. Mitchell was just scared the helicopter would come back or that the pilots would send police to investigate our strange camp. Barzee looked at him, but didn't answer for a second. I knew she hated this place. I knew she hated being stuck in the camp 24 hours a day. I knew she hated never being allowed to go into the city to party or to scavenge for food
or to see something besides the trees that were around us. I knew that, like me, she was desperate to talk to someone new. I didn't know what she expected out of a new place, but I suppose she thought it couldn't be worse than the situation she was in. So she hesitated, only for a moment, before she agreed.
Yes! God wants us to move on!
They started talking of all the places they could go, both of them getting excited about the possibilities. When you don't own anything or have any family ties or friends, and when you don't really care where you end up as long as there's a place to beg for food, the whole world opens up. They talked about New York, Boston, and Philadelphia. They talked about a lot of other places, too. My heart sank. I felt a tinge of panic and despair. All of the places they were talking about were even farther from my home. I always assumed we would eventually make our way back toward Utah. It was my only hope of getting rescued. No one had found me in California, but no one was looking for me here. But if we could make it back to Utah, I might be recognized. Someone might see me and realize who I was. They might call the police and save me without me having to do anything that Mitchell could blame me for. All of the places they were talking about were on the East Coast. No one would recognize me there. And I had seen how much effort it had taken to get to California. Months of planning. Months of ministering to get the money. It would be so much harder to come back once we had made it all the way out to Boston or New York. Once we were there, there was no way we'd ever come back west. As I thought, Mitchell started talking about his quest to obtain the remaining 6 young wives that God had told him to get. In fact, he said, it had been revealed to him that he was supposed to take 7 times 70 wives. But for the time being, he was willing to focus on just obtaining the initial 7. As I sat there listening to his drivel, an idea started forming in my head. I thought of all the ways Mitchell had justified what he did by using religion. I thought of all the times that he had gotten away with things by lying and manipulating people and their emotions. Down in the city, he used faith and scripture to manipulate people 12 times a day. It was what he did to get everything he wanted. It was what he did to get away with everything. At this time, religious discrimination was an especially touchy subject because of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Yet, Mitchell had even been able to turn that to his advantage. People were afraid of offending anyone, especially someone dressed in veils and robes. And Mitchell had been able to extract a lot of sympathy because of that. He had convinced a police officer not to even look at my face back in the library, all in the name of religion. I knew it was wrong to try to manipulate people. As a young girl, the only manipulating I had ever done was when I tried to get Mary Catherine to brush my hair or tickle my back or make me a grilled cheese sandwich. Even then, it hardly ever worked. I was not good at manipulation. And I knew that it was much worse to use religion to manipulate people. But as I sat there thinking about it, I started to develop a plan. But first, I had to get things right with God. I wondered if God would give me a one-time exception when it came to manipulation. Considering the situation I was in, I thought maybe he would help me out. While Mitchell and Barzee were talking about all of the places they could drag me off to, I knelt down and started praying. I begged God to let this plan work, just this once. I begged him to help me, and if he did, I promised never to try to manipulate anyone ever again. Once I had finished my prayer, I sat up and turned to my captors. I know this sounds crazy, but I keep having this feeling like maybe we should go back to Salt Lake City, I said. I know that doesn't make any sense, and I know that God would never talk to me about this feeling, but it just won't leave me alone. I turned my eyes on Mitchell, my voice soft and sincere. Do you think you could ask God if we should go back to Salt Lake? I know he will answer you. I know he will. You are his prophet. You're his seer. You are practically his best friend. I guess I stroked his ego just right because Mitchell didn't immediately reject my suggestion, and I could see that he was thinking, maybe,
My little Shir Jashub is finally getting it. Maybe she's finally acknowledging that I really am the prophet.
So he agreed to pray about it. Then, just like Moses, he stood up and went up on the mountain to talk to God. Sometime later he came back.
I think you're right, Shir Jashub, he announced. The Lord is beginning to work with you. That makes me very happy. We should go back to Salt Lake. Now, we just have to find a way to get back to Utah. We could beg for money to ride the bus. We could buy a cheap car. We could take a train. We can't fly, though. That takes too much money, and we don't have any ID.
He muttered on, wondering about the best way to get back to Salt Lake. I had an idea for that, too.
You and Hepzibah always talk about your trek across the country, I said. You talk all the time about how you used to hitchhike everywhere.
Mitchell stopped and stared at me with a look of surprise.
I think we should hitchhike back to Utah, I said. You and Hepzibah have hitchhiked all over the country. I have never hitchhiked in my life. My parents always dropped me off and picked me up. I think it's essential for me to experience that as well. I think it's an important part of descending below all things, that I may rise above them all.
Mitchell's face changed from surprise to shock. Barzee seemed to squint as if she was suspicious. But I knew I had him. He was caught with his own artillery. I didn't want to hitchhike all the way back to Utah, of course. But what I did want was to be in close contact with other people. Real people, not Mitchell and Barzee. If I could get close enough to other people, maybe there'd be a situation where I could be rescued or find a way to escape. But Mitchell shook his head. He didn't like the idea at all.
Far too risky, he said.
He and Barzee started to discuss it.
Surprisingly, Barzee agreed with me. It was something I needed to experience.
Mitchell finally gave in, but I could tell that he was suspicious of the idea.
I was so eager to get back to Utah. It was the only thing I could think about. I wanted to leave right away.
But there was a lot to do before we could be ready to go. We had to get some money for the journey. That was going to take some time. We had to sort through all of our belongings, packing up those things we intended to take with us. I had been through that before. I knew it was a lot of work. Mitchell said we also needed to plan an appropriate route back to Salt Lake City. We couldn't just stand on the side of the road, holding a sign that read, Salt Lake City. We had to plan a route that took us from one small town to the next, eventually working our way back to Utah, which left us with one big problem. Mitchell knew that people wouldn't pick us up if we were dressed in our strange-looking robes, which meant we had to get some street clothes. But that included great risk, for people would certainly recognize me if they could see my face and hair. I would have to be well disguised, or Mitchell would never go through with the plan. Mitchell didn't know what to do. He said he'd have to think about it. Still, I felt a wave of hope and excitement wash over me. After nearly 9 months of being enslaved, I had shown that I was more than a bystander in my own life, more than just a puppet in his hands. After months of grueling training and conditioning, I felt like I had finally kicked a goal.
Chapter 35, A Walk Through the Desert.
Surprisingly, it only took us 3 days to get ready to hitchhike back to Salt Lake City. We spent the first couple of days sorting through all of our belongings, throwing some stuff away and deciding what things we would take with us on our journey. I was surprised at how much junk we had accumulated. Most of it dug out of dumpsters or from other homeless camps. We sorted and decided, trying to keep our sacks light, a goal in which we failed miserably. But it was no easy thing for three people to do, hitchhike for 800 miles while dragging along literally everything we owned. After we had organized our things, Mitchell spent a little time ministering in the city to get some money. I never knew how much he collected. He certainly never shared that kind of information with Barzi or me. But I knew it wasn't much. That afternoon, he sat and stared at me. "We need to cut your hair," he said. "Cut it really short and dye it, too. That's the only way no one is going to recognize you." I shook my head defiantly. I wasn't going to let him. He'd have to hold me down to cut my hair.
"Yeah, we're going to have to cut and dye it," he went on. "And you know what else?"
He ran his fingers through his own hair.
"I might have to dye my hair as well."
That didn't make any sense. He wasn't a fugitive. He hadn't had his picture pasted all over the country. No one was going to recognize him.
But it made him feel important to think that someone might be looking for him, too.
He turned and smiled at me.
"Sher Jacob, how do you think I would look as a blonde?"
That one was easy. He'd look like an old man with dyed hair. He already looked like a cross between Rasputin and Osama bin Laden, and I didn't think a little blonde hair was going to change that.
Barzi jumped in. "I don't think you should make her cut her hair," she said.
I looked at her in surprise. In the 9 months since she and her husband had kidnapped me, this was the only time she had ever interjected to protect me.
"A woman's hair is her crown," she went on. "It wouldn't be right to make her cut it. You need to find another way."
Looking at her stringy gray hair, I realized that all this talk about cutting and dyeing our hair had bothered her. At the end of the day, she'd be left with a head of gray hair, and she didn't want to be left out. Still, I was glad that she had said what she did. Mitchell thought for a couple of minutes, unwilling to announce his decision. Then his face lit up like a light bulb.
"I've got it! We won't dye or cut her hair. We'll make her wear a wig instead."
Relieved to keep my hair, I nodded eagerly. But it wasn't as if it was a stroke of genius. Wasn't getting me a wig an obvious answer anyway? The next day, Mitchell took Barzi and me into El Cajon. We walked to one of the local strip malls and went into the dollar store. Of course, I thought sarcastically, the perfect place to buy a quality wig. I stood quietly beside Mitchell while he and Barzi tried to find the right hairpiece, a decision that soon developed into an argument. Looking at the selection, I had to cringe. The best way to describe them was old lady gray hair bubble. I rummaged around the rack, looking for one that was just a little less gray than all the others. Finally, picking out one that seemed to have a few more strands of brown, turning it over, I read the style name. Tiger Lily. The irony was rich. We selected that wig, then spent a whopping $1.29 on an equally stylish pair of sunglasses and walked out of the store. After we had made our way back to camp, Mitchell made me put on my disguise. He looked at me and smiled. He was as proud as he could be. It was like, voila! I didn't look like me anymore. But I knew the truth. I looked ridiculous. The shoddy wig hardly fit me, and I constantly had to adjust it to keep from showing tufts of blonde hair at the front of my head. The sunglasses were tinted green. We had found my pants alongside the road, and my shirt had been taken from a homeless camp. I looked down at my clothes and adjusted my wig, shaking my head in disbelief. Really? I thought. I was a 15-year-old girl in a gray wig and sunglasses so cheap, they didn't even sit straight on my face. Do you really think this is going to work? Who, in their right mind, is going to think it's normal for a young girl to be wearing a gray wig? Not to mention the fact that it was already falling apart. If it couldn't even make it through a day, how was it going to look in a week? But even though I knew I looked ridiculous, I felt like a princess compared to how I felt in the robe and veil that I'd been wearing for almost 9 months. The next day, we woke up early. Our nasty green bags were packed and ready to go. I considered our belongings as we hoisted them on our backs. We had a small purple tent, and I do mean small. It was barely big enough for two small adults, let alone large enough to get abused in every night. A couple of blankets, Mitchell's collection of holy books, and a few kitchen items, a little food, a little water, some of Barzee's clothes and personal belongings, a few of Mitchell's prized possessions, including his knife. Though it didn't look like much, it seemed to weigh a ton. Slinging the heavy bags over our shoulders, we made our way out to the highway. And so started a miserable, exhausting, and convoluted journey back to Salt Lake City. It took us a long time to get a ride. The first people to pick us up were a kind man and his son, who took us 20 or 30 miles down the road, then dropped us off at a campground, paid our camp fees, and even bought us some groceries. The next day, a young woman with two male friends picked us up. She spent a lot of time asking me questions, trying to figure out why I was wearing a gray wig and why I was with two misfits like Mitchell and Barzee. But Mitchell never let me talk. Whenever she asked me anything, he'd jump in before I had a chance to answer. Which was a relief. I could hardly even look at her, let alone answer any of her questions. I was so used to being alone, so afraid of making Mitchell angry, and so intimidated by human contact that it terrified me to be peppered with her questions. After 9 months of constant threats and manipulation, it was impossible for me to talk to anyone besides Mitchell and his angry wife. So though we rode with these people a long way, I never said a word. We spent that night on a hillside that ran beside the highway. All of our food and water was gone, and I was hungry and exhausted. Cars were rushing by like crazy. Mitchell didn't want anyone to see us, but the hill was barren and there was nowhere for us to hide. So we got up very early in the morning, broke camp, and started walking before the sun came up. We walked almost the entire day. It was hot and exhausting. I thought I was going to die from lack of water and the heat. Over the next several days, there were times when I felt like we were going to walk all the way to Utah. We got occasional rides, but many of them were only for a few miles, and then we'd have to walk again. Miles and miles went by as we trudged along, the green bags slung across our backs. We hardly ate. We suffered without water. Wanting to stay away from the highway patrol, we kept to the back roads and little towns. Pretty soon, we found ourselves out in the California desert. It was a stupid thing to do, trying to hitchhike across the desert without anything to eat or drink. At one point, we were standing at a lonely intersection in an unknown town. There was a pie restaurant on the corner, and a kind stranger took us in and bought us each a slice of pie. I've never eaten anything so delicious in my life. After we had eaten the pie, Mitchell snuck around to the back of the store where they sold the pies in boxes to ship around the country. He bought a whole pie and ate almost the entire thing himself, leaving Barzee and me only a sliver of a piece to share. With that little bit of nutrition in my belly, Mitchell herded us out again, heading north. My pack was so heavy. I was so tired, and the footing on the side of the road was so poor that I stumbled constantly. I'm not sure how far we walked, but it felt like an eternity before we finally came to a barren intersection with a sign that pointed toward Borrego Springs. Once again, I didn't have any idea where we were. Mitchell was the navigator. I was the pack mule. A woman in a station wagon pulling a small trailer stopped to give us a ride. As we climbed in, she said that she had never picked up hitchhikers before, but for some reason, she had the feeling that she should give us a ride. I felt so grateful. I was tired, hot, and hungry. To me, she was a saint. As we drove, she tried to tell us about her recent move to Borrego Springs, but Mitchell kept interrupting, telling her his story, how he was a servant of the Lord who had been chosen to preach repentance to the world. On and on he went. I started feeling sorry for her, having to listen to him for so long. She finally dropped us off at a small Mexican restaurant in another unknown town. After she drove away, Mitchell walked toward the restaurant. "Let's eat," he said. I was shocked. I had thought that we were out of money. We went inside and, for the first time, Mitchell let me order what I wanted.
It was the first hot meal I'd had in ages. I ate until I thought that I'd be sick. After eating, we walked along the highway until it grew dark, then left the road and headed off into the desert to set up camp. When we awoke the next morning, the sun was blazing hot, turning our tent into an oven. I crawled out of the tent, already very thirsty, and started packing up our bags. Looking around, I realized that we were literally out in the middle of the desert. The empty road stretched into the distance, the only indication of civilization that I could see. Nothing but desert and barren hills in every direction. No sign of life at all. I paused to listen. The stillness was absolute. We started walking. The road seemed to grow gooey from the rising heat. After an hour or two, we ate the last of our food. Old carrots mixed with vinegar and a can of black olives. We didn't have any water. We kept on walking. By noon, I was starting to believe we were committing suicide by thirst. An occasional car sped by, but none of them stopped or even slowed down. I was as miserable as I had ever felt. But Mitchell seemed to love it. It gave him an opportunity to show his physical prowess. Plus, he loved the idea of suffering for the Lord. I could almost read his mind. I'm just wandering in the wilderness and waiting upon the Lord. I glory in persecution, for when I am weak, then am I strong. Finally, some friendly Mexicans picked us up and took us a few miles to where there was a fork in the road. After they dropped us off, we stood at the intersection, waiting for Mitchell to figure out which way to turn. As we waited, a woman in a blue car stopped beside us. She had passed us before, then had gone into the nearest town, bought some hamburgers, turned around, and brought them back to us. I eyed the hamburgers hungrily. Another kind woman. Another saint. After she left us, we started walking again. It was at this point that things got a little strange. As we headed into Blythe or Brawley, or something like that, an old and cankered Winnebago went cruising by. Looking at the creepy motorhome, I was glad it hadn't stopped. But all of Satan's children recognized their own, and as I watched the Winnebago speeding down the road, I was distraught to see it pull over, then turn around and come back to pick us up. It took a long time before the door flew open. Then the driver beckoned for us to climb in. The interior was dark and eerie, and I wanted to run away. I started to back up, but Mitchell pushed me forward and forced me to climb on board. The interior of the motorhome was as disgusting as I had imagined. For one thing, it was filthy. For another, every inch of the water-soaked walls was covered with cutouts of naked women. Alongside each picture, the driver had written what he wanted to do to that girl. To call it creepy was an enormous understatement. Mitchell, of course, felt right at home. The driver looked at us and said, "It took me a minute to open the door because I had to take down some of the cutouts that would have been offensive to the ladies." I looked around in disgust. "So this isn't offensive?" I wanted to say. I shook my head. "You know, that's why I stopped to pick you up," he said to Mitchell. "You have these two ladies with you." He was talking to Mitchell as if we weren't even there. I felt like one of Mitchell's cows or something. And the driver never took his eyes off of me as they talked. It was obvious what he had in mind. They kind of talked around it for a moment, but Mitchell made it clear that it wasn't going to happen. The man nodded. "Okay, no big deal. They could still be friends." Soon after that, Charlie, the Winnebago driver, was telling us about a nudist camp that he was heading to. "Want to join me?" he asked. Of course Mitchell did. Charlie drove us to a secret oasis in the desert where there was a warm spring. He kept staring at me, waiting for me to take my clothes off. But Mitchell wasn't going to share me even visually. Handing me a large t-shirt and some old shorts, he told me to put them on. The spring felt cool in the hot afternoon,
and there were lots of naked people around, the vast majority of them old and wrinkled as dry prunes. We sat in the cool water surrounded by palm trees until the sun had gone down. That night, we set up the tent outside of the old Winnebago. Charlie tried one more time to make an agreement with Mitchell, but Mitchell continued to refuse. The next day, Charlie took us to a small town outside of Las Vegas and dropped us off. But he kept turning his motorhome around and circling back to pick us up again. Mitchell, wanting nothing more of Charlie, forced us to hide in the bushes along the road. "You're mine," he proclaimed. "I'm not going to share you. I don't care if he gave us a ride." I felt my stomach churn. So he wouldn't share me for a ride. But what if he got a better offer? The thought made me feel sick. After Charlie had finally driven off, we started walking down the road again. Another ride from a nice man in another decrepit car left us at another intersection on a nameless road in the middle of the scorching desert. We started to walk again. No water, no food. The day passed with no one else offering us a ride. The next morning came as hot as ever. We walked and walked, always hoping for someone to pick us up, but the cars kept zooming by. By then, my light skin had been sunburned to a painful cherry red. My cheeks and nose were blistered and bleeding. The sunburn was very painful, and having to carry the heavy bags across my sunburned shoulders only made it worse. Finally, I took one of Mitchell's undershirts and wrapped it over my head to protect my neck and face. As evening approached, I was desperate for want of water. I really didn't know how much further I could go. Suddenly, a white truck pulled over. A young man jumped out and started handing us bottles of ice-cold water. He told us that he had passed us on the road and had gone up to the next town to buy some water, then circled back to give it to us. Another act of kindness. Another saint. A bit more strength to go on. A few rides and a lot of walking later, we finally made it to Las Vegas. We immediately made our way to the nearest place to eat. While we were inside the Burger King, a lot of people stared at us, always whispering to each other. Nothing unusual about that. But this was much more than the normal amount of whispering and pointing. Mitchell was starting to get nervous. He shifted anxiously in his seat, his narrow eyes darting around. His hands were always moving, flittering in front of his face. Seeing his growing agitation, I grew nervous too. What if something goes wrong? I thought. What if he blames me? What if he hurts my family? The moment we finished our food, Mitchell got up and commanded us to go. As we were walking across the parking lot, a police car drove up. The officers got out and started questioning Mitchell. I couldn't hear everything they asked, but Mitchell was always calm and cool. "We are ministers for Christ. This is my wife and my daughter." One of the officers looked at me. I immediately dropped my eyes. The officers questioned him a little longer, but there was nothing they could do. There were lots of strange people in Las Vegas. We weren't the only ones they would stop that day. After a few minutes, they got back into their patrol car and drove away. Free of the officers, Mitchell was frantic to get out of Vegas. His face was tight with fear, and he croaked in fury as he turned to me.
"Once we make it back to Utah, we will go to the upper camp. There you will stay. You will never leave the camp until the Lord has said it is time to come out."
Until the Lord said it was time to come out? I knew that meant forever. I started shaking with fear and dread. That wasn't the reason I had wanted to go to Utah. I needed to be seen around the city if I was ever going to be rescued. No one would find me on the mountain. I closed my eyes and started praying. "Please, God, help me find a way." We walked toward a nearby gas station, where a bunch of semi-trucks were fueling up. Mitchell went into the truck stop to use the bathroom. While he was gone, one of the truck drivers walked over toward Barzee and asked if we needed a ride. The driver was a little worried when Mitchell came out of the building and he realized that we weren't traveling alone, but he agreed to take us anyway. We climbed into his truck,
Barzee got in the front seat, while Mitchell guarded me in the cab area where the man had his bed. Mitchell asked the man how far north he was headed. The man said he was going to Orem, Utah. My heart started pounding. I would almost be home. We rode in silence for most of the way. As night settled, Mitchell told me to go to sleep. The next thing I knew, he was shaking me by the shoulder, telling me we had to get out. It was either very late at night or very early in the morning. We climbed wearily out of the truck and thanked the man. Inside, my heart was singing. I was back in Utah. I was almost home. Chapter 36. I am Elizabeth. The darkness was full around us. It was biting cold, and I realized I wasn't used to the Utah cold weather any longer. I wasn't sure where we were, but I could hear the hum of the freeway to my left. The parking lot was dotted with yellow security lights, and there was no one else around. I could barely make out the outline of the mountains to the east. Dark shadows against the starry sky, their snowy peaks glistening in the night. I thought I recognized the distinctive peaks of Mount Timpanogos, which put us somewhere south of Provo, but I wasn't sure. Looking at my surroundings, I felt a rush of joy. It was early March. It had been almost 6 months since we had left Utah. I was so glad to be near my home. Mitchell looked around, his eyes darting here and there. He was very nervous. It was the first time I had been in Utah without my robes and veil, and this was deep in enemy territory, back in the very heart of the state. He stared at my ridiculous wig, the crooked dark glasses, and the clothes that didn't fit, then shook his head. Have I made a mistake in doing this? The uncertainty on his face seemed to say. He motioned to a park on the other side of the highway. I thought I saw a sign that read Camelot, but it was very dark and I couldn't tell for sure. Mitchell started jogging toward it, picking up speed as he ran. He's scared, I realized as Barzee and I followed him toward the park. We crossed the highway and walked through the gate. As we got closer, I was able to read some of the signs. We walked past King Arthur's Round Table and moved to the back of the park. Picking out a patch of grass beside a gentle river, we set up our small tent. A shiver ran through me from the cold, and I realized that my single blanket was not going to keep me warm. Before we went to sleep, Mitchell raped me, as he always did. It would prove to be the last time. Mitchell woke us early. The morning was gray and cold, the grass thick with heavy frost. I could see my breath inside the tent, and the sides of the fabric were dripping with condensation from our breathing. My body ached from the cold, and being crammed inside the small tent with two adults who would just as soon lie on top of me as give me any room. We climbed out of the tent before it was fully light, Mitchell pushing us to hurry. He wanted to get out of the park before anyone saw that we had been sleeping there. I took the tent down as quickly as I could, but my fingers were icy cold and it was difficult to make them move. After packing up our gear, we headed out of the park. We walked along the frontage road for a short distance before we came to a convenience store with a McDonald's inside. Food! I was so hungry. We walked in and placed our order. The woman at the cash register mumbled as she explained that it was hard for her to talk because she had had her wisdom teeth out the day before. Mitchell kept asking her all kinds of questions, and it was obviously painful for her to answer, so she was happy to hand us our food and get us on our way. We headed to a booth and stuffed our breakfast down in silence. As soon as we were finished, Mitchell herded us out of the restaurant. Standing on the sidewalk in front of the store, Mitchell took a look around. It was still early, and there weren't very many cars around. But there was a young man who was getting some gas, and Mitchell walked up and asked if we could get a lift. The young man looked at us suspiciously. I knew that we looked like a bunch of dirty vagabonds, but he hesitated only a moment before he said, "Sure, jump in." We climbed into his car. As I got into the back seat, he looked over his shoulder.
Be careful, that door is broken. It might fall off in your hands. I could see that the inside panel was barely hanging on, but I got the door shut and we took off. He took us to Orem, but that was as far as he could go. When I got out of the car, the door panel fell off in my hands. I'm so, so sorry, I said as I tried to put it back in place. Don't worry about it. It's not your fault, he laughed. I fixed the door as best I could, then got out and the young man drove off. We headed toward the bus stop, which was not very far away. Tons of people were around. Most of them couldn't keep from staring at us, causing me the usual embarrassment and shame. We climbed on the bus, which was so crowded that many of us had to stand. I kept my eyes down, staring at Mitchell's feet. He kept very close, never more than a few inches away. His eyes were always moving, darting here and there. Farzee seemed withdrawn, as if she had resigned herself to whatever lay ahead. Since the night the devil and his angels had tortured her by cutting her body in two, it seemed she had lost a lot of energy. Most of the people on the bus were either students or business people heading into the city, and we stood out among the well-dressed crowd. As the bus swayed along, I looked up to see a young man staring at me. I lowered my head again. I still could feel his eyes on me, and my heart started racing. So conditioned was I to being alone, and so conditioned to feeling terrified of Mitchell's threats, that I immediately withdrew from any human interaction, even if it was just a glance. After a few minutes, the man moved toward Mitchell and started talking to him. "Who are you?" he asked. Mitchell didn't say anything. "Where are you headed?" The man was trying to be nice. "We are ministers of the Lord," Mitchell answered. "Ministers? Really? What do you believe?" Mitchell obviously didn't feel like preaching. He answered the man's questions only briefly, not really saying anything. I glanced at the young man out of the corner of my eye. He nodded at me. "Why is she wearing a gray wig? Is that part of your religion?" I glanced toward Mitchell, seeing the panic in his eye. "We believe many things," he answered curtly. He was very defensive. His voice was sharp and on edge. The young man didn't seem to care. He pressed a little harder. "The way she is dressed, the wig and stuff, is that part of some religious ceremony? She is so young. Is it designed to teach humility or something?" Mitchell refused to answer. Taking me by the elbow, he edged me toward the front of the bus. The young man watched us curiously. We got off at the next stop, leaving him to stare at us through the dark windows as the bus pulled away. Standing on the side of the road, Mitchell held my elbow in a painful grip. "Once I get you back to camp, you will never leave Shir Jashub. It is too dangerous. I will not lose you. I will not put myself in danger. I am too important to the world. You will go to the camp and stay there. That is the Lord's desire." I thought back on the way the young man on the bus had looked at me, the way he had challenged Mitchell, the way he had kept his eyes on us while the bus had driven away. Mitchell had been shaken by his advances, but I would pay the price. We waited for the next bus, then jumped on. I don't know if Mitchell even knew where the bus was going. He just wanted to get off the street. This bus was not very crowded, and no one asked us any questions. We sat alone, surrounded by looks of disgust. But that was no surprise. We were filthy and we smelled bad. I wondered if I'd ever feel clean again. We only went a couple of miles before Mitchell forced us to get off the bus again. We had made it beyond the point of the mountains that separates the Salt Lake Valley from Utah County. I looked at the mountains on the east, recognizing their features. We were very close to my grandparents' house, less than 20 miles from my home. I flashed back to summer afternoons, playing in their backyard that had been flooded by the irrigation ditch, bobbing for apples, playing with my cousins. It felt so good to be so close to home. Then I thought of what Mitchell had told me. "You're going to spend the rest of your life up at the camp." My heart sank again, my stomach tying into knots. We were standing on State Street, one of the main roads that leads downtown. Mitchell started walking without saying where he was going. Barzee and I followed as we always did.
We walked into a Walmart where he stole some new hiking boots and some other things. Our green bags were bulging with the stolen items by the time we made it to the front of the store. Mitchell paid for a few things to relieve any suspicion. Then we walked toward the door. People were always looking at us. We just didn't fit in. Passing by the main entrance, I glanced at the wall with all of the pictures of the missing children. Am I up there? I wondered. I started walking toward the wall, scanning the photographs. Mitchell grabbed me firmly by the shoulder. A sharp pain moved up and down my arm. He squeezed tighter and leaned toward me.
You are not up there. No one remembers or cares about you anymore. You are mine. You'll always be mine. Your previous life is over. Now come on, let's go.
He started to pull on my arm, but I pulled back, staring at the pictures of the children. I don't know why, I just couldn't seem to pull away. So many children, so many shattered lives. But I didn't see my picture, which meant that Mitchell was right. Everyone had forgotten me. I was not on the missing posters anymore.
He jerked on my arm again. Quit calling attention to yourself.
I turned around and followed him out of the store. We walked down State Street toward the middle of the city. We were on 106th South Street. We had a long way to go, but I knew what was going to happen. We'd take another bus downtown, then walk east toward the university, then up the canyon toward our old camp. Then I'd be in my prison, and Mitchell would be home. I walked wearily, dragging my feet. I felt like I was walking toward a penitentiary with my personal prison guards. I had felt this way before. We had only walked 2 blocks when I saw the first police car. It came up and stopped immediately beside us. Mitchell cursed. Barzee sucked in a breath of air, her throat seeming to gurgle. We kept on walking. I kept my head down. Another police car came up and stopped beside us, then another one in front. I heard Mitchell cursing once again.
We shouldn't have done it, he hissed in fear. We shouldn't have done this.
His voice was tight with rage. I felt sick. I felt elated. I didn't know what to do. I thought about every threat that Mitchell had ever made about my family. I thought about the painful life that lay before me in the camp. Years of being raped. Years of hunger and abuse. Years of being trapped up on the mountain. I thought of everything that I had gone through. All I wanted to do was go home. Then I thought about my little brother and sister. I loved them so much. I wanted to keep them safe. The policemen jumped out of their cars and walked toward us. Please, help me protect my family, I prayed.
Sir, I need to talk to you, the first policeman said.
Mitchell kept on walking.
Sir, I need you to stop. I need to talk to you.
Mitchell didn't answer. An overwhelming feeling of panic swarmed over me.
Please, God, help to set me free. Sir, I need you to talk to me. I need to see some ID.
The officers became aggressive, all of them shouting now. Mitchell's eyes were wide with fear, his face draining of all color. He stammered once or twice, trying to get something out, but his voice seemed to crack. Barzee didn't say anything, holding close to her husband, her lips tight across her teeth. She glared at me, her eyes hateful and defiant. I flashed back to the scene at the library when she had pinched my leg underneath the table, her iron fingers digging into my skin, communicating all of the fear that I had been subjected to for months. I looked at her, then turned away, my mind a jumble of hope and fear. Another policeman came toward us. His voice was firm. He seemed to be in charge. The other officers gathered around. Though they were talking to Mitchell, their attention was primarily on me.
What is your name? One of the officers asked me.
I felt almost dizzy. I was sick with uncertainty and fear.
What is your name? He asked again.
Was it Esther? Was it Sheer Jashub? I hadn't been called Elizabeth for so long. The officer frowned at me. He didn't treat me like I was his friend. I felt like I was falling over a waterfall.
Don't say anything. Don't give Mitchell a reason, or he'll hurt you. Don't give him a reason to hurt your family. Hey, I need to know your name, the officer pushed again.
What will Mitchell do to me? What will he do to my family?
Your name, the officer demanded.
Her name is Shir Jashub, Mitchell finally answered. The officer only glanced at Mitchell. Is that right? Is that your name? I thought of the long black knife. I thought of the fact that Mitchell had never spent more than a few nights in jail. He seemed impervious to being captured. He would kill my family if I talked. Where are you from? The officer demanded.
We just got here from California, Mitchell answered for me. We are preachers. We aren't doing anything but serving the Lord.
The officer ignored him. Is that right? He asked, looking into my eyes.
She is my daughter.
Where are you going? The officer asked me, moving a little closer.
We're heading to Salt Lake City, Mitchell answered for me again. We're ministers. We've done nothing wrong.
His voice was calm and cool now. There was no sign of panic or deception. He spoke softly and acted very confident and sure.
I'm not speaking to you, sir. I'm speaking to the young lady.
The officer stared at me, waiting for me to say something. She's scared, one of the officers whispered from the back. She doesn't dare say anything. The officers huddled together, a couple of them keeping their eyes on Mitchell and me. Farzee seemed to have melted into the background. It was as if no one cared that she was even there. She's scared of him, the officer said to the others. She's too scared to even answer. You've got to get her by herself. One of the officers walked toward me and put a gentle hand on my shoulder. I immediately flashed back to when Mitchell had grabbed me in the Walmart just a few minutes before. Mitchell's hand had been like a death grip, like the Grim Reaper on my arm. But this was different. It didn't feel like the officer was going to hurt me. Maybe he could actually keep me safe. He nudged me away from Mitchell, then leaned over and looked me in the eye. What is your name? He asked me gently. I felt my heart racing in my chest. More than anything, I wanted to tell him. I didn't want to stay with Mitchell. I didn't want to walk with him up into the mountains. I didn't want to be raped every day. I didn't want to suffer hunger anymore. All I wanted was to be with my mom and dad. All I wanted was to go home. But Mitchell's face filled my mind like a monster in a dream. I heard his voice. It was the devil. I had heard it so many times before. I will kill your brothers and your little sister. I will kill your mom and dad. I will plunge my knife in and I will turn it. I will kill them all. The officer waited, then leaned toward me, looking me right in the eyes again. When he spoke, his voice was soft and assuring. Are you Elizabeth Smart? Because if you are, your family has missed you so much since you were gone. They want you back. They love you. They want you to come home. For a moment, my world seemed to absolutely stop. I looked at him. He looked at me. I felt calm. I felt assured. Months of fear and pain seemed to melt before the sun. I felt a sweet assurance. I am Elizabeth, I finally said.